Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. I'm joined today by fiction author Annie Hartnett. Her first book, Rabbit Cake, was listed as one of Kirkus Review's best books of 2017 and was a New England Book Award finalist. Her second book, Unlikely Animals, just came out. It's already receiving accolades. It's about a natural-born healer whose big plans for life got turned upside down, leaving her feeling lost. When she returns home to her troubled family in a small New Hampshire town, well, let's just say things get complicated. Unlikely Animals is described as a modern fairy tale that beguiles and breaks the heart. Filled with wit and unforgettable characters, living and dead, and a riotous, joyful, hilarious romp with the wild and the tamed. Annie Hartnett received fellowships from the McDowell Colony and SUNY Writers Conference. She has an MFA from the University of Alabama. And again, her new book is Unlikely Animals. Let's meet Annie Hartnett. Annie Hartnett, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you. We haven't talked before, and I always like to find new and different authors, and this is certainly a different kind of story. I want to just begin with your background, because I understand that you actually didn't want to be a writer. You wanted to be an artist.
Yeah, when I was a kid and a high school, I really wanted to be a Disney animator or a cartoonist, and I was sort of following that path a little bit, taking art classes. I was an art major in high school. They let you like sort of pick a major, and then my art teacher, senior year, who I had had all high school, and then she taught a AP art history class my last, last year, and she pulled me aside and said, "I have to tell you, Annie, I know you love art and that's what you want to be, but you're a much better writer than you are an artist."
Well, that was a blessing in a way, because, I mean, did you take that to heart at the time, or did you kind of get defiant and think, "I'll show you"?
No, I didn't get defiant. I actually thought it, I sort of laughed it off, because she was often saying sort of things to me that were just a little bit like putting the knife in. It did make me sort of rethink, okay, someone's really telling me that I'm not that good at this. And so when I got to college, I didn't major in art, and I majored in philosophy instead. So I didn't really know at that point either that I wanted to be a writer.
Right, right. Well, I think, my sister's an artist, and I look at her work and how easily she does it, and I'm like, how do you do that? And I even took a cartoon class once, and I was like, no, I think I'll stick to writing.
Yeah, I mean, there were people in my high school who were clearly more talented than me. So I should have been able to figure it out on my own. But
you've had some great opportunities as a writer. You spent some time at McDowell. Tell us a little bit about that, what it is, and what you did there.
Yeah, so McDowell is one of these magical places, which feel like from another time, where artists of all different disciplines come together for various periods of time. I was at McDowell for a month. McDowell's in New Hampshire, and so they have composers there. They have painters there. They have at the time I was there, there was my friend Amy Kurzweil, who's a New Yorker cartoonist. And so I was there to write, and I wrote much of my book, Unlikely Animals, there. And Amy actually got me back into drawing, and so I do draw now, and I drew for people who had pre-ordered the book. So I made over 450 drawings. So drawing is now a part of my life again, although I do think I am a much better writer than I am an artist. So that's still true. But I'm glad to be drawing again.
Right. Well, the front of the cover of Unlikely Animals is covered in foxes, illustrations of foxes. And And Fox is one of my favorite animals, and it has an integral part in the story, but we'll get to all that in a minute. Let's look at how this came to be, because you were actually writing a different book or a different storyline. You weren't particularly inspired by it, and wondering, is, you know, a second book's always this difficult. was the first one the magic? You're driving in New Hampshire and you see this big yellow mansion, and it kind of changed the trajectory for you. So tell us a little bit about that moment, because I think, you know, all great ideas are spurred in a moment, and how that led you to creating a whole new story.
Yeah, so I was writing this one book, but like you said, I was just feeling like the second book is not going like the first one did. It's not as much fun to write. And so I'm visiting friends in Newport, New Hampshire, and we're driving along, and I come across this huge yellow mansion, and it's just looks like the nicest hotel you've ever seen, but it's not in a part of New Hampshire where there are other mansions. So I'm so confused about what this place is. Our friends had just moved there, and so they didn't know. And there's no trespassing signs at the base of the driveway. So I Google, you know, huge yellow mansion, Newport, New Hampshire, and what comes up is a little history lesson in this guy who was a robber baron, Gilded Age robber baron, and he had moved back to his hometown and built this mansion, and then with all his millions as his retirement project, bought up 26,000 acres, fenced it all in, and started a animal hunting park, shipped in animals from all over the world. And so if anyone has read my first book, Rabbit Cake, they know that I love animals, and I just became sort of obsessed with this history, even though I don't write historical fiction, but wanted to know more. And it was kind of like this magic moment of inspiration, lightning strike. So I went to the historical society in town to, you know, find out more, and found, just looking through their documents, found this man, Ernest Harold Baines, who was a real-life Dr. Doolittle who had animals living in his house, foxes, bear, deer, and he was the naturalist for this park from 1904 to his death in 1925. But I was still writing that book that I had started, which was a dark comedy set in 2014. But so I wove all this stuff into that book, and Ernest Harold Baines, the Dr. Doolittle character, appears as a ghost in the book. Since his work is in the public domain, I'm able to use a little bit of his work and his real photographs, or his wife's real photographs, of him and the animals.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it creates a great part of the story. So let's give listeners a brief synopsis. Your protagonist is Emma Starling. She was born a natural healer. She's kind of lost her way. She's dropped out of med school. There's so many layers to the story. But she's, I want to begin with her because she's somewhat disillusioned with her life. She's dropped out of med school. As I said, she doesn't have the best relationship with her parents. But we meet her as she's driving home to spend time with her father, who's dying. So tell us, take it from there.
Yeah, so Emma's father is dying, and she's coming home, a med school dropout, and she thought kind of her whole life that she was special because she was born with this. So there's a slight bit of magic in the story. She's born with a slightly magic healing touch. And so she's come home, dropped out of med school because she feels that she's lost this magic touch that she's born with. Like, the nurse picks her up and says, "This baby cured my sciatica," and that's what she's known her whole life. But she knows that her father is dying from this mysterious brain disease, and so knowing what she knows about her healing touch, which she still, a lot of it is a mystery to her, she knows that she never had enough healing power to heal her father. So much of the book is about that feeling when you're an adult, realizing that your parents aren't going to be around forever and that you're sort of powerless to stop them from dying, from leaving you, even though you thought maybe once you're an adult you'll be all-powerful and you'll be in charge of everything. And so she kind of has to realize that in her 20s, in this more magical way, but it's But it does feel relatable in ways that I have felt before with my parents, feeling like, oh my gosh, I can't hold on to them forever, and then there's nothing I can do about, you know, time passing on.
Yeah, yeah. It's my mother. It was 10 years this weekend since she's gone, and it feels like 10 minutes, you know. So let's talk about her dad a little bit, because he has this mysterious brain disorder, and this cracked me up, because you do have quite a fair bit of humor in this book, and I laughed at this because I had a similar experience with my mom, who had Parkinson's disease. They put her on these new meds, and the line in the bit in the story is the father, Emma's father, is teaching in a class, and he suddenly says, who's let these cats in? Well, I had taken my mum to the bank, she lives in England, taken her to the bank to say, look, I pay all her bills online, but I need access to her money, you know, while I'm visiting here in case anything happens. So the bank manager leaves to get a form, and when she's gone, and I told my mum, behave yourself, because she had a raw sense of humor, she suddenly said to me, why has the cat got a sweater on? And I said, what cat? There's no cat in here. I said, stop it. And I thought she was joking. I said, behave yourself. Bank manager's coming back. She'll think you're incompetent. You know, you'll get locked up. And she's like, no, the cat's he's right by the fire and he's got a sweater on and he'll get too hot. But it was actually medicine, new medicine that was giving her. We pulled her right off it. So, but it made me laugh out loud because I could so relate to that situation. But it's not a funny disease, but there are some funny episodes around it. So tell me how you crafted the dad and you wove in his ghost buddy, Ernest Harold Baines, and the fox.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my writing in this book is interested in a lot of like the situations that you just described that are sort of like horrible things, but the only way that we can get through them is to laugh about them. So that those become so much of how we are able to, like, sort of muddle through life and through the hard stuff. So this book is full of zany situations that are both can be heart-wrenching, but also are laugh-out-loud funny. And Clive, as a character, once I had the ghost, once I had discovered Ernest Harold Baines as a real person, became even more an interesting character to me as someone who has this brain disease, but also has a friendship with a ghost who lived with animals in his house. So that was going to lead me fun places. And then he was just a fun character to write anyway, because not just because he's sometimes confused, which can and has like a little sort of connection to the ghostly world, but he was also like a very dynamic person. He was a poetry professor who's been forced into retirement, and he was sort of, he's a narcissist a little bit, and he's also, but he's also in a Black Sabbath cover band called Blacker Sabbath, and he loves attention, and he's just like the person that I would want to hang out with, and I'm really interested, I think, in both my books about people who are such big personalities and what happens to the world when they are suddenly gone, and both like sort of the amazing thing about someone who is a larger than life person or character, and then the tragedy of losing them.
Yes, one of the other ghostly threads through the book is the voice, the collective voice of the cemetery, the ghosts in the cemetery. A very unique approach there. Tell us how that came to you and why you took that approach.
So, so Ernest Harold Baines was the first ghost that appeared in the book, and he appeared sort of earlier on in the process. And then I wanted sort of a John Irving feel of a novel, that I wanted a lot of things to go together and add up to something bigger. And so I had written this omniscient third-person narration through the book. And then I had a friend, Lucas Mann, who's a great writer, and he said, well, someone needs to be telling the story because you're telling too many jokes, Annie, and, you know, omniscient narrators, third-person omniscient narrators don't usually have a personality. And so I thought, okay, well, who could be telling the story. And I was up at McDowell at the writing retreat, and that is where Thornton Wilder wrote Our Town. And I thought, oh, is this a crazy idea to try to do, you know, an Our Town style narration? But I tried it, and it made the whole book make sense, because I was trying to connect this 2014 novel with this novel that was interested in the history from, 1920s, with the Ernest Harold Baines character. And the people that would care about both those time periods is the people who are in the cemetery, who have been either there the whole time or have been, you know, who have absorbed so much of the history just by sitting in the cemetery. So there's people in the cemetery that died 200 years ago, and there's people in the cemetery that died yesterday, and they all just sort of sit around and talk and tell stories. So they are very fun narrators, because what they care most about is telling a good story and loving the people of this town. So there's a lot of love that's sort of infused in the book, because the narrators love the living people so much, even when they make big mistakes.
Right. And this town, Everton, is a made-up, it's a fictional town. You actually drew a map of it in the... Did you draw that map in the front of
the
book?
I did draw the map.
I thought maybe you had. But there's a map in the front, which I always love, because it helps you, you know, get a clear picture of where everything's at. Why did you choose to do a fictional town?
Well, so it's based on that real town, but then some of it's based on a town that is north of Newport. So there's two towns, because this park, which is still around today, it's still fenced in, it's 26,000 acres and it spans five towns. I also just don't, I love to take little seeds of real life, just things that happen to me or things I read about, or and put it through like my imagination machine and make it, like, I don't particularly care about telling the truth. I care about making people laugh and making people feel. So I would never, as far as I know as about myself as a writer now, want to use a real town, because I would miss out on too many jokes. Like, even, you know, if you've seen the map of the town, there's tons of jokes just embedded in there.
Mm-hmm.
Like the hair salon that only does buzz cuts is called Sheer Imagination. That's just the type of thing that makes me laugh, even if no one else notices it.
Right. And we want to, when we're reading, escape. And, you know, sometimes books can get a little too real. It's nice to escape and imagine there's this wonderful land out there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I always loved Cabot Cove in Murder, She Wrote.
You
know,
yeah.
Until I saw it, you know, in L.A. on the Hollywood set. But... So let's talk a little bit about some of the research you did for this, because not only did you research the Corbin Park, the canned hunting is a term that I read a lot when I was looking up myself on Google what this was all about. Interesting place in a way that only a certain few millionaires can actually hunt there. But you also have her brother, Emma's brother, Augie, is in rehab. So I'm assuming you had to do some research on that, because New Hampshire is one of the top opioid crisis centers, right?
Yeah, so I did, even though I don't feel bound to trying to recreate my real life or the real life that I experienced in a place, am inspired by what I do notice in the world, and so spending a lot of time there. And I did try to get all the history in the book right, other than, you know, sometimes they make it a little more fanciful.
Mm.
But the history and Ernest Harold Baines' writing in the book is all true. And sometimes most of it is even verbatim of when I'm using his writing. But so when I was in Newport, New Hampshire, and talking to people and hearing stories about what goes on in town, and also reading newspaper articles about the town from sort of an outsider's perspective, like the Boston Globe city perspective. The opioid crisis is one thing that just comes up and comes up and comes up. And so I did, there's a missing person in the story, who is Aunt Emma Starling, the main character's friend from high school. And no one is looking for her, and that was sort of what I, you know, as a writer was like, okay, well, no one might be looking for someone, and often this is the case, no one looks for people who they can sort of come up with a explanation of where they've gone, if they were known to use drugs, that is one explanation. So that was sort of where it started to creep into the book, and then Emma's brother has been struggling. He's gone to rehab twice. And so I first wrote it into the book. I didn't really intend for it to be a big part of the book, but it did become, I am so interested in figuring out, you know, who gets help and who gets support and who gets saved in many ways in this book. And that became something that really fit in with the things that I was trying to explore. And so I did do a lot of research and had a few of my friends read the book who had more personal experiences with this, and then read a book and watched documentaries. So I did feel like I had to make sure that I was being sensitive and responsible. But I think ultimately it became like a big Augie's journey is one of the parts of the book that I think is the sort of one of the emotional hearts of the story.
Right, right. You also capture extremely well that feeling of a small town, of the community, myself, I've always liked anonymity, but there are people who love everybody to know everybody, and the gossip that goes on there and doesn't go on. I mean, gossip is gossip, right? So half of it's made up. But tell us how you feel about that and how you captured that, because you did a great job.
I love gossip, and I love knowing everything about everyone else. When I was in Newport researching Ernest Hyle Baines, I was in the library asking the librarian, you know, if she knew anything about him, because I felt like I'd tapped out the Historical Society already. And someone across the room pipes up and says, oh, he was quite the womanizer. And I love that so much, because this man died in 1925, but his gossip remains.
Right.
So when I'm thinking about history and I'm thinking about, so town gossip, it just, a small town is just so, so rich of history and gossip. So I love, especially for fiction, small towns. I've lived in cities and I've lived in small towns, and I'm happier with more space. So I think I might be a small town person, but I've only been in a small town for about a year.
Hmm. Well, I read on your website that you inherited three things from your mom: love to read, love to sit around and talk, and wine. And of course, that second one, sitting around and talking, I love to hang out with people and chat. And that's almost a lost art form these days. It's like people have to have a purpose to meet up and an agenda to meet up. And I always enjoy when I can just sit and hang out with someone and chat.
Yeah, nothing is better for me than just no agenda, and we just sit and talk.
Yeah. So there's a lot of layers in this book. They come together beautifully. What was most challenging for you as you were developing the story, as you were writing?
I think probably the most challenging thing, and the thing I like the most, is fitting the puzzle together. I wanted a book that had a much grander plot than my first book had, and I wanted to write like that, like I said, the John Irving style, a lot of different things come together to make one big thing. I was really inspired by reading some of his books, and so making sure that puzzle worked, and that even though there are so many sort of different threads in this book, and it's kind of almost feels overstuffed, I wanted it to feel overstuffed, but then sort of the marvel of it all adding up to something at the end, like a magic trick. That was both something that I was worried about pulling off, and so drove me a little crazy, but it was also the most fun, and is one of the things I'm most proud about this book.
Right, right. So your first book was Rabbit Cake. What did you do differently? How did you approach, other than wanting a bigger plot, how did you approach writing unlikely animals differently? What did you learn from writing Rabbit Cake that you then maybe improved upon or stretched upon in Unlikely Animals?
Rabbit Cake was all driven by the voice of that main character. It's about a 12-year-old girl named Elvis who has lost her mother. Her mother was a sleepwalker. So it starts with also a slightly magic premise, and then it's really about her exploring her grief. She hears that a normal grieving period is supposed to be 18 months. So she approaches it like a little scientist, where she's trying to track her grief, which we know as adults know is not possible.
Right.
So it's a very heartwarming and funny book because she's a very funny character, even though she's going through this extreme grief. I learned that she was such a strong first person narrator and has such a strong voice, and people who like that book it's because they fall in love with the voice. So I had to write a book that was not a first person book, and so that was the first choice I made. Is I think I could do a first person now, but I could not at that time. And then I just sort of learned to lean into the things that I think make my writing different than some other writers, which really, there was one review of Rabbit Cake that said, sometimes Hartnett veers towards the silly. And I took that really personally because it was like it was a positive review, but it was a sort of negative comment. And I thought, you know, well, that's true. I think that that's not something I disagree with. I think that that's true, but I wouldn't say that that's necessarily a negative thing about my writing. It's something that I'm more interested in silliness and fun, and then sliding the knife in, then making, you know, something that the emotional impact sort of sneak up on you. So I had a plaque made, and I'm looking at it right now. It's over my desk, and it says, "Veer towards the silly."
I love it.
And so that is where this book came from, was really leaning into that.
I love it. Well, Jeff Vandermeer put a blurb on the front of your book. He calls it a wondrous and wonderful story filled with unforgettable characters, both living and dead, an instant classic. Do you have a favorite character in the book?
Oh, yeah, I love Clive the most.
That's the first time an author has ever come out so quickly and admitted to loving one the most. They usually say, "I can't choose."
he's my favorite.
Yeah, well, he is a character for sure, and you know, quite a bit of humor around him, even though he's very ill. So I want to throw just a couple of words out at you, Annie, and get your instant response to them. The first one is discipline. What does discipline mean to you?
Routine.
Okay. And what about creativity?
Routine.
And spontaneity.
Routine. It all comes from routine. That's the way my brain works, at least, making myself do it so that all the good stuff comes out.
I love it. And I saw on your website you have a, not a workshop, but a writer's gathering. I'll let you explain it, but it's all about being accountable and getting people's butts in the chair, because, as you just said, it's getting that butt in the chair that is really important. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing there.
Yeah, so we just started this. It's for writers that are looking for a routine. So it's kind of an anti-workshop, because we won't be workshopping people's actual books. And it works for people who are writing fiction or people who are writing memoir. We have one TV writer actually in it, and so it's going to be, and it starts June 1st, and it's going to be a groups of people who we're going to pair up in groups of, you know, 6 to 8, I think is what we're going to do, small groups, where we help you commit to your work. So we will have twice monthly meetings, and then daily check-ins from me and my co-coach, Tessa Fontaine, and we've been accountability partners for like 4 years now, and so we're going to help other writers with what we've learned by working together.
Yeah, that's awesome. Accountability partners are great if you get the right person. So that's a good way of doing it. Before I let you go today, I just want to say you have a border collie, Mr. Willie Nelson.
I do. He's right here with me.
So beautiful. I have a border collie named Mr. Dylan Thomas.
Oh, they always have to be misters, don't they?
Well, you know, they deserve some...
Some regalness there,
yeah. So I know listeners can find out much more about you, Annie, at your website, anniehartnett.com. Final thoughts you'd like to leave listeners with today?
Oh, I would just love to hear from anyone who reads the book. I hope that you have a chance to pick it up and let me know what you think. Yeah, you can email me through my website at anniehartnett.com.
Okay, great. Thank you. And the book again is Unlikely Animals. My guest, Annie Hartnett. Annie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.